The White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Your host, Carolyn Yeager.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, on this Saturday afternoon, September 29th, 2012. I'm Carolyn Yeager, coming to you live from the White Network for the next 2 hours. I want to remind those of you listening to me live today that Robert Lloyd's debut show on the White Network will be coming up at 6 p.m. Eastern, or in other words, 4 hours from now. It's a really interesting and fun hour that you will enjoy, so do stay around for that if you can. Robert's show is called Rockin' the Music World, and today he's featuring the great composer Beethoven. Well, I can also tell you that my email account is up and running, so you can email questions or comments during the program to Carolyn at CarolynYeager.com. I'm having a little trouble with my throat today, and you know, it just came up about 4 minutes before the show starts, so I know it has to be some kind of psychosomatic thing, but I hope it will clear up as the show goes on. Today my guest is Don, a lawyer from California. Don was previously on the Heretics Hour with me last March 26th on a program I titled Freedom of Association for Whites. We discussed, among other things, how white people can direct their own lives, such as who they live around, who their kids go to school with, who they employ in their businesses, and so on, and how all this has become very difficult and, in fact, basically illegal now since the 1960s. So Don's ideas on that program got good feedback from the listeners. But I would say that nothing has moved forward too much since, but he might disagree. We're going to find out from him. So let me welcome Don to the program. Hi, Don.
Hi, Carolyn. It's very nice to be back. First of all, I'd like to congratulate you on setting up your new network. That's a very ambitious and a very important undertaking. We need every white voice we can get, and yours is a very strong and a very clear voice. Second, thank you for having me back. I enjoyed the last time you had me on, and I really look forward to this one as well.
Well, we all enjoyed it. I'll just mention that we've been working on background noises, and you're wearing your second headset. The first one had a background noise. This one now is coming up with a little bit of rumbling, but I'm not sure. We weren't able to solve it, so it might come and go. I'm not sure if the listeners hear it, but we'll just ignore it. And because once you get used to something in the background, you get used to it and you don't really hear it anymore. So if people are hearing that, well, I want you to know that we're aware of it, but we can't do anything about it at this point. Well, Don, I listened to that program from March just a little while ago, and you said people are fed up with this stuff. Particularly, you mentioned Trayvon Martin, the Trayvon Martin case, and you had said that that people were really mad. You said people, they've had enough of it, and of course you had clearly had enough of it, and you were fed up. You were fed up with all this stuff, and you thought that things were going to change, that people were going to wake up and do something. Well, my question is, do you see signs of that, or do you see that what has changed in this last 6 months, and where does that Trayvon Martin case stand?
Well, this is 2012, which is a very significant year because it's a presidential election year, and so there is a heightened awareness and a heightened amount of discussion and agitation on just about every conceivable issue. And now that we have our first African-American president, there's a heightened amount of agitation on the race issue. One aspect of that is the Trayvon Martin incident, The Trayvon Martin incident is actually a very, in and of itself, a very insignificant, comparatively insignificant. What made it important was the fact that it was selected by the arbiters of public discourse in this country to be kind of a rallying cry against white people and in favor of non-white interest. We saw Obama, who has absolutely no jurisdiction or no authority to do anything in this matter, interposing himself and saying if he had a son, it would have looked like Trayvon Martin. This enraged a lot of white people. You know, we see these black flash mobs all over the country. One wonders if he would be so willing to claim any of them as his son when you see videos of them, you know, beating up white people and kicking them senseless and unconsciousness as they lay in a pool of their own blood on a sidewalk in Cincinnati or Seattle or some other city. Clearly he would not. Clearly he really stepped in it with that. There's something pathological about Obama. He just can't help himself. It was clearly a foolish thing to do that would antagonize a whole lot of people. He has no need to pander to the black vote. He already has, you know, 98% of it. So why say something that's not going to get him any more black votes, but it's going to lose him white votes? And the answer is because he can't help himself. He is a pathological racist, a pathological white-hating, Western civilization hating psychopath. I mean, the whole issue of his background and his life is a subject for a whole nother show. But you ask about the Trayvon Martin thing and what is the status of it. I think it's gone very, very badly for the blacks. The case has largely died down because the physical evidence in the form of injuries to Zimmerman, he had significant lacerations on the back of his head, a broken nose. And while, you know, Trayvon Martin essentially, except for the gunshot wound, had no sign of injury whatsoever. I heard Zimmerman's brother on a local talk radio show here in Los Angeles, and he was very presentable, and he presented a very calm, rational case on behalf of his brother, as you would expect. And this family were not Jewish, as was originally reported. They were raised as Catholics. They attended Catholic school. And Zimmerman, the defendant, has been very active in pro-black advocacy and pro-civil rights and pro-equality types of stuff for much of his life. There's no history of racism on this man's part. So whether you have any use for him is one issue. The most important thing is this case has died. It is no longer a rallying cry for the black civil rights industry. And I don't think Obama's going to have very much to say about it. I predict an acquittal for Zimmerman on the murder charge. I don't see murder here. So there may be, you know, voluntary manslaughter or involuntary manslaughter, but, you know, that's separation.
Yeah, right. But why should he even have to be, you know, found guilty of that? When you pointed out some of the details that he had a lot of lacerations and Martin didn't have any, and, you know, he had a role to play and as a watchman in the neighborhood. I mean, this is once again, when people carry out their duties that they've been given, and then if it becomes politically a problem, they're just thrown to the wolves.
Well, this is a show trial. This is a show trial that has been engineered and designed for the purposes of inciting hatred against white people, and inciting hatred against white people for political purposes goes back a long way. We remember in the 1990s when you had the great black church burning hoax that Bill Clinton gave some speech about how he had vivid memories of church burnings in Arkansas in his youth. And, I mean, in the pre-internet days, how do you have vivid memories of church burnings in the middle of some rural area if you weren't there helping with the burning? But separate and aside from that issue, somebody did some research and they found that there were no church burnings in Arkansas. The man was exposed as a complete liar. But the issue was not so much that he lied. The issue is that he was willing to incite hatred against white people in order to get black votes, and nobody considered that to be hate speech. Notwithstanding the fact that it involved a false accusation against an identifiable race for the express purpose of inciting hatred against them. My God, if you talk about, you know, allegations against the Jews from 2,000 years ago, you know, you get fired from your job and personally and professionally destroyed. But whites are entitled to no such protection as the favored minorities. And, of course, we all know the reason for that. They're the arbiters of public discourse in this country, and they have the ability to determine what items get on the agenda and what items don't. And that's the reason white voices are very important, because we're off the agenda. We're not talking about this today, and because of any permission from the Jews, or because any powerful people have decided that this is an appropriate subject, we're in complete defiance of the most powerful aspects of culture. And I think the issue of justice for white people, equal justice for white people, is slowly but surely beginning to bubble to the surface. The death of the Trayvon Martin thing is kind of emblematic of that. I think you have alternative media now in the form of talk radio, Fox News, and most especially the internet. And they have the ability to really put a hold on a lot of this stuff in a way that did not exist in the 1950s or the 1960s. Blacks could burn down American cities with impunity, and the media, political, civil rights complex would come into would be essentially the only voice, except some guy publishing his own little newsletter, you know, in Mobile, Alabama, or something. And what power did that have? Now you have the internet. You have alternative media. That is a huge change in this country, and I think that's one of the reasons the Trayvon Martin fraud has really been stopped largely in its tracks. I don't think you're going to see much effort to transform that into a political football.
His parents are probably still making money, going to make plenty of money off of it. They'll probably have to be bought off. Well, yeah,
Who
asked you.
Make money?
His parents.
Oh, his parents?
Yeah.
They'll probably file a claim against the Homeowners Association. I'm not sure how far that's really going to go. I don't know much about that. There's been so much misinformation. He was the captain of the neighborhood watch, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. I don't know that any of that really means very much. And I'm not sure there's going to be a big payday for the family. Somebody will probably kick in and off. Some insurance company will get involved, probably the homeowners insurance for the condominiums or the townhouses there, and they'll throw them a bone to make them go away. But apart from
that... Yeah, but that bone will probably be pretty nice. But
For them, it's nice. I don't think it's going to be a lot of money in the scheme of things.
Yeah, well, that's good. That's good. So what were you going to go on about? Because I did want to ask you about, just in general... because you had said that you thought that there had been progress in the last 6 months.
I think there is an awakening in white racial consciousness. Pat Buchanan has written a book about it, and he's written a couple of columns about the fact that there are inherent racial conflicts between these different voting blocks. He wrote a very good column a couple of months ago, and Rush Limbaugh featured that on one of his shows and talked about it in great detail. Now, I'm sure we all have no illusions about Rush Limbaugh. I think at many levels he's a very dishonest man, a Judas goat. But on the other hand, he's got 20 million listeners, and 20 million people were exposed to something they might not otherwise have heard about, and that is the fact there are irreconcilable differences between the races, and those are now expressing themselves politically. You know, I followed talk radio for some time, and I remember the day when all these so-called conservative talk radio people were in favor of open borders. They said, oh, you know, we're a nation of immigrants, blah, 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 let them in. These Hispanics are all social conservatives, which is a complete delusion and a fantasy. That's why there's so many Hispanic street gangs here in Los Angeles and in other metropolitan areas, because these people have such great social conservative values. Are you kidding me? These conservatives, some of them are just nuts. I mean, they say, well, Barack Obama can't possibly want to destroy the economy of this country because he wants to get reelected. And what president has ever gotten reelected in a bad economy? Well, the answer is Franklin Roosevelt got reelected three times with a disastrous economy by socially conservative people. You know, I had Southern Baptist grandparents and family members who were as socially conservative as you can imagine, who were all great fans of Franklin Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. So a lot of this conservative stuff that we get fed by these Jews like Michael Medved and these crypto Jews like Rush Limbaugh is simply nonsense. But the point I'm making is now all of them, virtually all of them, come out against illegal immigration. Why did they change? Why did they flip-flop? Because their audiences drag them. Audiences are migratory, and they know that. you know, it's almost, they don't pay too much attention to very many things, but they pay attention to their emails. And you hear Rush Limbaugh say this, Sean Hannity say it, Michael Medved, all these people read their emails. They are very sensitive to their audience. And I think these conservatives like Hannity and Limbaugh, and even to some extent Michael Medved, have been dragged kicking and screaming on to the right side of the illegal immigration issue because their audiences, they got to listen from their audiences. So we do have some power at that level. And I think that the change in these so-called conservatives reflects a greater voice of white people. So you have Rush Limbaugh acknowledging Pat Buchanan's analysis of the racial divide in this country. And granted, Buchanan is not a perfect person, but you have to start somewhere. And he sets that issue out very forthrightly and very clearly. And I got to believe there are a lot of people in that 20 million audience who got on the internet and downloaded Pat Buchanan's column and read it, and they were influenced by it. Mm-hmm. There's another thing, and this is not a very scientific thing, but you know, I've been on the internet now about 10 years, and I remember as recently as 5 or 6 years ago, if you would write something that was even mildly critical of the protected minorities, you know, you'd be deleted, you'd be banned from a website. And now you go to these a lot of these websites, and I write stuff that's pretty out there, pretty in your face. They talk about the achievement gap between blacks and whites. Well, I say, yeah, of course there's an achievement gap. 500 years ago, there was an achievement gap when white people who mastered shipbuilding and navigation skills traveled all around the world and they encountered Africans who couldn't invent the wheel. Hell yes, there's an achievement gap, and there always has been and probably always will be, and you better learn to live with that fact. I'd have been kicked off the internet for writing stuff like that, and was kicked off the internet from conservative sites as well as liberal. 5, 6 years ago, now you see stuff far worse than that. You know, these flash mobs and these black criminal episodes, you see those on mainstream websites. And now you read the column section, my God, you can't believe this stuff. It reads like something you would see on Stormfront. But these are just rank and file people. Another thing is just people I encounter, white people I encounter. You know, used to be I'd be sitting in an office with some lawyer. We'd be there alone, and the doors closed. We're sitting there alone. And the guy would kind of look over his shoulder and lower his voice in order to talk forthrightly about race. I don't see as much of that now. I see people coming out and saying, hey, if they don't like it here, then go to some place where they'll be happier. And it's not people that are signed on the Stormfront or who listen to the white network. It's just regular rank-and-file people who have had enough. And now you've got an interesting book out, too. Another sign of this is a book called Mugged by Ann Coulter. And I haven't read the book, but I've heard her on talk radio and on The View. And, you know, Whoopi Goldberg called her a bitch and told her she was full of bullshit. And basically, Ann Coulter is a neocon. We all know this. Yeah. But she talked about how white guilt was very destructive and nothing ever good out of came out of white guilt. And there's a lot of stuff there. She tries to tar the Democrats with racism and show the great Republicans were not racist, and more Republicans as a percentage supported the Civil Rights Act and Martin Luther King than the Democrats, who were all dirty, rotten segregationists. Well, you know, we all know that's where she's coming from there. It's like Glenn Beck had his show about the black founding fathers. It's a lot of baloney. But it is showing it's an attack on the concept of white guilt. That is progress.
Progress. You think that they really care about these things, or are they just moving around, as you mentioned earlier, to fit their listeners out there and their supporters and so on, so that they stay on in tune with them?
I don't know whether
they really care. You don't think it matters that much?
I don't think it matters whether they care or not. I think it matters that they are being pulled in a direction that is good for us. Now, I think Ann Coulter is enough of a white person that she recognizes this black baloney, this stuff. She's dealt with these phony black intellectuals, these phony black reverends, and these phony black celebrities who make a living out of calling white people racist. Whites have had it with that crap. They've just had it with that. And more and more, I mean, it's one thing to talk to people on Stormfront it's another thing. When I go to a social gathering, you know, I used to be quiet about my racial views. Now I come right out with them. And if people don't want to hire me as their lawyer because of it, screw them. You know, I see even black people have had enough of it. I see black people that are tired of the whole racial issue. They just want to work and make their money and live their lives, and they don't really want to go out and start a big crusade. They're still going to vote for the Democrats. But even they realize that a lot of this racial rhetoric and the attacks on white people is a scam. And I'll tell you something else. I do a lot of work in real estate, and I got a referral. I gave a lecture at a real estate investors club about landlord-tenant law and real estate. Black guy comes up to me after the show. Turns out this guy owns about 35 pieces of rental property in South Central L.A., and he's acquired them over the years, acquired a fair amount of money. He's financially independent, lives off his rental income. And he talked to me, took me out to lunch one day, and we had some very forthright conversations. And basically what he told me is Mexicans are taking over black neighborhoods, and they're basically kicking the blacks out. He says he's got a couple of rental properties that have been taken over in areas by Mexicans. He can't even go manage his rental properties because he's afraid he's going to be shot by Mexican gangbangers. And he says, as bad as white people may have been, he says, I've never been threatened with violence by white people. White people never called me a nigger. But these Mexicans, they're just impossible to deal with. And he said, he's basically, the reason he wanted to talk to me is he wanted to sell out and leave because he's afraid of continuing to live here. He wants to retire. And the point he made is that when white people go down, he says, the intelligent, prosperous blacks are going to go down with them. He said to me very forthrightly, he says, I couldn't own rental property in Oakland or Detroit and very probably in any black majority city. He says, I can own rental property in Compton because that's part of the greater Los Angeles metropolitan area. And when my tenants don't pay the rent, I can go to court and I can get them kicked out. And a white judge will kick them out. He says, if you can't kick people out for not paying rent, they aren't going to pay rent. Mm-hmm. He says, how am I going to pay the taxes? How am I going to pay the insurance? Blah, blah, blah. And he told me he had a house the Mexicans just moved into. And he went out there and they called him a nigger and said, look, you don't like it, we'll burn the place down. Screw you. We'll pay your rent when we're good and ready to.
Does he go to court then? Does he go some, you know?
Well, he wanted me to get involved in that. You know, and I said, you know, sorry, I'm too old to be shot by Mexican gangbangers. I don't want to get involved in that. But the point he's making is he can't civilize blacks. Have an understanding. They may not be able to go to the family Thanksgiving dinner and come out and say it. They're just as gagged and muzzled as we are. But if when white people go down, they go down with them. Because he says, I could not own rental property in Detroit. They'd burn the goddamn place down if I went and knocked on the door and said, pay your rent. You know, they got hundreds of empty houses in Detroit.
I've thought it would be a good idea to get to let a racial war get going among blacks and Hispanics and mestizos and let them reduce the population of both.
Well, whether you it's happening, whether you think it's a good idea or not. And they had a news story last week about a race riot in Victorville. The blacks and the Mexicans are going at it. And this has been going on in the Los Angeles school district for many, many years. There was a good black guy, Terry Anderson, who used to be very active in the anti-immigration.
I remember him.
And he talked a great deal about how black kids were being set upon by these Mexican gangbangers. They're virulently racist against black. You see, all this hatred against white people. Whites are the best friends the American blacks ever had. Yeah, I know we had slavery. We had Jim Crow. They had to sit in the back of the bus and drink from their own water fountain. But by and large, you know, blacks always wanted to move into the white neighborhood. They always wanted to go to the white school. They didn't run away from white people, but they're sure as hell running away from Mexicans. It's Mexicans that are shooting black kids. It's not dirty, rotten, white racists.
Well, it's so, probably Mexicans in the area you live in, Southern California, and now all over California. But it's Mexicans who have driven the blacks to realize that whites are their friend, whereas before they would have attacked whites, or ripped off whites as much as they could. But now that the Mexicans have moved in, they see what can happen.
Well, I'm not saying
I'd like
blacks
to see them both go at it with each other.
Well, so would I. And I mean, I'm not saying blacks have suddenly had this revelation that whites are their friends. I mean, the vast majority of rank and file black people hate us just probably more than they ever did. But I'm saying there's a few smart white black people there that have figured out that their destiny, if they're going to have any kind of financial or civilized destiny, is tied to white people, the success of the white majority, what's left of it. And I just think there's a measure of irony there, is that you always hear about white racism, yet it's not white racists that are shooting black kids or kicking black people, shooting black kids or kicking black people out of their neighborhoods. It's the Mexicans, and this whole Mexican invasion has been a disaster for blacks, for rank-and-file blacks. Right,
exactly. And speaking of Terry Anderson, when I used to listen to him, of course, he comes across as just like another white guy, really, only who happens to be black. But he still is black, and, I mean, he knows, you know, what side to be on, what's best for him. But he still is black, and he represents black people. So, you know, here at the White Network, I know you don't totally subscribe to that, but we take the view that whites have to be totally on our own and not ally with any other races, because that always weakens us, weakens our resolve, and makes us think we've got friends where we don't really have them.
Well, that's just part of it. I don't know that we have to ally with them, but I think if you can reach an accommodation with people and say, you have your town and we have our town, you have your schools, we have ours, I don't think we need to start a war where there is no need for one to exist. I think if in the natural course and scope of things, we would have developed the kind of duality in this country where the races would have been separated. And in accordance kind of with the ideas of Marcus Garvey. Of course, you know the story of Marcus Garvey. He was a black voice and a black nationalist, and the powers that be decided that, that black independence and black businesses and black success was not in the interest of black people. The only thing that was in the interest of black people was to attach themselves marsupial-like to the wagons of white people and drag both races down. So that's where we kind of are in that regard.
Well, yeah, and he was against that, right? And
was a great admirer, actually, a great admirer of Hitler and Mussolini.
That's right, and but then you have all those people, including all those white people and the abolitionists and so on, who absolutely didn't want blacks to separate from whites. They wanted to bring the two races together in the nation, right?
Well, we talked about this offline about the historical thread of self-hating, white self-hating pathology. And, you know, we think in terms of multiculturalism and all cultures are equal and all people are equal. And we've always kind of been presented with that idea, and that it was something that kind of originated with the Boas anthropological academic movement in Columbia University. I think his name was Frederick Boas, the Jewish anthropologist who kind of promulgated this modern version of multiculturalism and universal humanity and universal equality. And it really existed before that, going back to the early 1800s and possibly even before that. I mean, I think we can understand opposition to slavery. Slavery was a fundamental contradiction in American society. You can't promulgate a government, a republic, based on the idea that you have equality before the law and then have slaves there, have slave traders. And the whole fugitive slave movement, whereby people who oppose slavery in the North were going to be forced to aid in the enforcement of slave laws, and the idea that the Southerners wanted to suppress free speech. The Southerners wanted to ban, slavery denial. They said that, and this is kind of interesting, you can read the congressional discussions in the 1830s where they talk about people who criticize the institution of slavery are creating an atmosphere, an environment where violence can occur, and there can, you can suddenly have all this, you know, slave uprisings and murders and movement. These people are going to claim their freedom. And they said people who criticize the institution of slavery are tantamount to accessories after the fact for murder. And this was a very famous Southern congressman. I forget his name, but his speech was set forth in a book called Arguing About Slavery by a historian named William Lee Miller. A book that was published about 10-15 years ago, very, very interesting book. But you know, what does this is the 1830s, and what does this sound like where they want to suppress a certain type of speech that will create an atmosphere of violence? This is like the hate speech thing, where they say white people can't talk about white interests because if they do talk about it, it's going to create an atmosphere. They're going to bring back slavery. They're going to bring back Jim Crow, you know, blah, 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 where this kind of attack on free speech was launched by people who wanted slave owners, politically powerful slave owners in the Old South who wanted to use the suppression of free speech to silence criticism of an institution that was the basis of their income stream.
Well, to get back to the to what you mentioned, self-hating whites, the abolitionist type people in the North, then I can't quite think that they were that it came from self-hating whiteness. That there was some other, there was something more going on there. And then we know that the slave trade itself was backed and has always been throughout history before it ever came to the United States. Backed by Jews. Jews were always the main slave traders in other cultures in Europe and so on, in Portugal, Spain, and so on. So here, you know, and then they don't want, if they were really against taking these poor Africans out of their culture and out of their home where they were comfortable and bringing them here, why wouldn't they want to send them back? Because it wasn't that long of a time. And there was a plan to create this Liberia and to give them all some money to create this nice country for them in Africa and spend a lot of, you know, spend the necessary money to set things up right there. But they were all, you were mentioning, they're all against that. And they're still against anything like that. So it all sounds like some type of Marxism that's been going on forever, or at least, well, pretty far back. In trying to bring alien people into white nations, white empires, etc.
Before I get into my response, before I address that, do we have a break coming up that I need to plan
no,
for?
No, we have another 28 minutes before.
Oh, okay,
our
all
musical
right.
Break.
I'm thinking in terms of half hour segments.
Yeah, right.
And I was waiting for the music to start, and I didn't want to start off on something, and then okay. Well, here's my response to that. The reason I discussed the efforts of the Southern slave owning elite to attack free speech, to attack the ability to talk about something that was a threat to their income stream, is to show that this is kind of a recurring thing. It's kind of like, you know, slavery denial. They wanted to criminalize slavery denial in much the same way that Jews want to criminalize Holocaust denial, because the Holocaust is an international multi-billion-dollar cartel that has a multi-billion-dollar income stream arising from, you know, reparations, taxpayer-subsidized monuments, movies, books. The whole thing, it's financial. It's an income stream. And so you see, the Jews want to use hate speech to criminalize criticism of an institution that gives rise to their income stream in much the same way that slave owners wanted to criminalize free speech that was an attack on an institution that was the source of their income stream. I just wanted to clarify that point, that these things tend to be cycles in history, and history does tend to repeat itself at a certain level. Elites try to protect themselves in a certain way, and crushing the freedom of other people outside that elite is one of the recurring ways they do it. Now, we talk about, you know, white self-hatred and white pathology. The thing that gave rise to that was my study of American history, and I like to read original documents like diaries and speeches and correspondence. Because you get a flavor for the people, you get a flavor for things. You see a view of history that is largely concealed and brushed over to the extent that white history is considered something that's even a respectable subject for discussion among decent people. And one of the things I read were the great speeches of the Henry Clay and Daniel Webster. And Henry Clay delivered a speech. He was in the very famous United States Senator, and he delivered a speech in the Senate in February of 1839, where he talked about petitions for the abolition of slavery. The slavery question reared its head at the Constitutional Convention in 1787. If you read Madison's notes on the debates, where he talks in detail about the Constitutional Convention, there, you know, they talk about the divide that was already beginning. I mean, you can see the seeds of the American Civil War sown, even in the immediate aftermath of the War for Independence. It's just that clear. But in 1839. Henry Clay was a senator from Kentucky, and he talked in this, he was talking about the slavery question, and this was a question that just wouldn't go away, and he talked about the abolitionist. He says the abolitionist strenuously opposed all separation of the races. Now, as we know in the study of the history, the whole issue, how do you deal with a racial problem? And one way to deal with that was the issue of colonization. And earlier than that, you had our government and private charity had helped create an African colony of freed black slaves in Liberia. I think it was under President Monroe, hence the name of the capital city of Liberia, Monrovia. And, of course, the first thing the freed blacks did when they went back to Africa was enslave the local blacks and make them go out and pick the cotton. But that's a separate issue. And Clay talks about the abolitionist pathology, and even against colonization. And he says, if I can just quote from a brief passage from this 1839 speech, "I confess to you, sir, that I have seen with regret, grief, and astonishment the abolitionist opposition to the project of colonialization. No scheme was ever presented to the acceptance of man, whether it be entirely practicable or not, that is characterized by more unmixed humanity and benevolence." He says, "Colonization deals only with the free man of color, and that with his own free, voluntary consent." And so we see in the 1830s this desire to amalgamate the races. And he says, "They proclaim indeed that color is nothing, and that the organic characteristic differences between the two races ought to be entirely overlooked and disregarded." So you see this
and who's saying song? This? Who are some of the examples of?
Well, he doesn't. Well, I mean, it's in the abolitionist literature. He doesn't cite to the he's delivering a speech, and of course, you know, these are, you have like abolitionists such as the Channings and Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Thoreau. These things are very, very well documented. He doesn't identify him in his speech, but he talks about this complete disregard for the personal preferences of the people involved. He says, notice what he says. He says, "Colonization deals only with the free man of color and with his own free voluntary consent." They even wanted to thwart the personal preferences of free black people to go establish their own separate country. First of all, and second of all, the idea that race, physical and organic characteristics can be overlooked and disregarded. I mean, these are two kind of pathological things. You know, your abolition, abolish slavery and establish freedom. Yet when it comes down to freedom, these people are completely contemptuous of the personal preferences of white and black people who want to maintain their separation.
Yeah.
Now, I was astonished to read this because I didn't think this kind of pathology came into being until the early 20th century with the Boas movement and these various other movements, which were movements that were going to use getting, you know, social justice for the blacks as a battering ram to destroy white civilization. But this stuff goes back a long, long way. Even Kevin MacDonald has talked about this. And he says he almost thinks that there's some kind of hereditary strain, some kind of genetic, anomaly. I wouldn't necessarily call it a defect, but just this pathology whereby these white people have no regard for their own interests, nor for the personal preferences, the free choices of people of color. They're bound to determine that all people are equal. They should come together and produce this kind of coffee-colored race. It was kind of astonishing for me to find out that this stuff existed as early as the 1830s, and that Henry Clay talked very forthrightly about it in the United States Senate. This is not some, obscure thing. I'm sure the people to whom he spoke were very much aware of it. And one of the reasons abolitionism had such a bad name is that abolitionism was not simply securing the liberty for these people held in slavery. It was a form of social reconstruction and social engineering whereby the races would be thrown together, even over their own personal objection. So,
you know, when I was young, I was very inspired by Ralph Waldo Emerson. That I was reading in my father's books, you know, in the bookshelves at home, more than from the library at that time. And I found these books and I read this stuff and I thought, oh, this was really, it was so inspiring, you know, and so idealistic. And I was a big fan of Thoreau, too. And when I think now how, you know, what is that all about, that kind of idealism? Seems to be totally people who have no, don't have the life experience that they probably would need to have with the people they're writing about. And it's very similar to the French Enlightenment writers, Rousseau and all of that, where they're just dreaming about what could be some kind of ideal world. You think it could be that rather than a pathology or a genetic anomaly?
Well, I don't know about that. I'm no expert on genetics, certainly. I got my degree in history, and then I went to law school. But you see this. You speak of, yeah, Waldo Emerson and Thoreau. You know, I read the Norton critical edition of Henry David Thoreau's on Walden Pond and his essay on civil disobedience when I was in college. I used to like to go to swap meets and garage sales. You could buy books for 25 cents. And, you know, I bought Mein Kampf for 25 cents. And I used to read all these weird books. I was one of those screwballs who read books instead of watched football games and drank beer, you know. So in any event, Thoreau's books were very well written and very, very insightful at one level. But he said some things that I found very disturbing, even back then in college in the late 60s. He said, you know, he lived as a hermit on Walden Pond, and he wrote all about nature and very, very subject. But he said something. He said he didn't much like parties and social events like that because he thought it seemed like the whole purpose of these social events was so that young people could meet people of the opposite sex and get married. And he spoke rather contemptuously of that idea. And I thought,
reminds me of some people now.
If people don't get married and they don't have children, you know, where the hell does that leave us, you know? And this was in the 60s before we had any of this thought of the mantra and white genocide. And in those optimistic days, we thought the white racial majority was pretty secure in this country. But I do remember that phrase from his book, and he was so contemptuous of the idea that young people would meet for the purpose of you know, meeting members of the opposite sex and getting married. I thought it was rather strange that he would condemn that.
Yeah, so, it is. I don't recall that, but I would have just passed it by. I thought, oh, that's right.
But what kind of society do you have where people don't marry and produce families? You have a one generation society that has a very, very, that has a dead end. You're becoming extinct. And it's amazing. He was so big on the right of blacks to get married and be secure in their families, but he was rather contemptuous of white people who wanted to marry and find families. There's something very bizarre about it. And I think that is kind of one symptom, you know, to use a medical term, one symptom of this self-hating, white-hating pathology that, you know, these people were dedicated to the proposition that blacks could have families and get married and enjoy all the civil rights, but they're very contemptuous of white people who want to do that. I mean, I understand there's some people who are not destined to marry and have children, but you know, by and large, they're not always the happiest people, and you know, you have to recognize the value of other people who do marry and have children. I mean,
most people do.
They may spend their weekends, you know, watching television instead of reading great books like I do. But God, they produce children, and I didn't. So, you know, we all have a role in society, and I thank God for people who produce children. Thank God for my mother who produced me. And I don't regard it as any great mark of success in my life that I didn't have children and marry. I think that was probably a shortcoming on my part without getting too, you know personal about
things. Well, I think a lot of us who go back far enough, at least into the 60s, got a lot of input about that and somehow just didn't follow, just got kind of sidetracked from a lot of that.
I was the product of that age, and I was a product of this idea that you have mm-hmm. contempt for women who have children, why women should be, you know, doctors and lawyers and run for the presidency. And I look back at my own childhood. I was raised with a stay-at-home mother. She was a registered nurse, and she was a very educated woman. But, you know, when my sister and I were old enough to care for ourselves, she went back to work. She worked part-time. And I look around today. I know of a family, two white people, two white lawyers, both work very hard, very successful people, law firms in Century City on the West Side. They had a problem. Their kid was, you know, they enrolled their kid in school, and the school called them in and said, hey, your kid doesn't speak English. How is this possible? It's possible because the kid's raised by Consuela, the housekeeper.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
they didn't even notice that his English was
deficient. They didn't notice their own kid really spoke English. The kid was, you know, 6-7 years old whenever the kid went into school. They said,
wow.
You got a problem here. The kid had to be tutored in its own language. You got all these successful people. To the extent that they have children and all, who the hell's raising their kids? And I thought, thank God I was raised by a quote-unquote just a housewife instead of a woman lawyer. If I'd had woman lawyers are miserable people. They really.
I feel exactly the same way. I mentioned that, I think, just in the last program with Marina Orwell, that I was, you know, fortunate enough to be brought up by a stay-at-home housewife, but even though I didn't like that term housewife ever, and I thought I don't want to be a housewife, but I was benefited from my mother being, you know, accepting that, even though she wasn't really a housewife, but she did love her house. She did take real good care of her house.
I'll tell you, I needed a mother a lot more than I needed a lawyer when I was a little boy.
Right.
And, you know, when I was, we moved to Canada when I was in the middle of the first grade, and Canadian schools were really tough compared to what I came from in this country, and I had a really, really hard time. And, you know, today, of course, you would go down and say, well, you know, the people in whose country I'm living, they're not paying enough taxes. They need to invest more in education. But back in those old-fashioned days, it was considered to be the parents' obligation to help their kid, and it was the kid's obligation to behave and succeed. And my mother tutored me. I wouldn't be a lawyer today, you know, but for the love and the dedication of my mother. I would be a real basket case. And I look at some of these white kids today, my God, they're like rudderless ships. And I look at, they were raised by a single mother, boyfriends in and out. And I mean, no wonder that white children have been cast off and abandoned. They really need our love and our support. And I'm not so critical of skinheads as I used to be. You know, the tattoos and all that crap, well, fine. Put on a long sleeve shirt and then you don't see the tattoos. They need our loyalty. You know, we cannot throw any of our kids out of the boat, even the skinheads who say things we don't like and have tattoos. You know,
we ought to close down all the tattoo parlors. And these people wouldn't be able to get tattoos. I don't so much blame the people, although it's stupid, but you know, that they're too available and they see them on other people and some people just go crazy and they're really horrible looking.
I got enough things on my plate without a crusade against tattoos. I go to the gym, everybody's got them and you know,
I might start that one.
They're not hereditary, and you know the main thing is to get their mind right and get them to be productive, happy white people. You know, if they got a tattoo, that's a youthful indiscretion, and that's a separate issue. But the point I'm making is there's got to be a loyalty to our people and a feeling that our people, our race is
well. That brings up
just like an individual person.
This brings up something that I don't mind bringing up. Someone brought it up in a comment. I think it was Nick. And I went and listened to a program that had Merlin Miller on it, who is the presidential candidate for the AP3 party, which the most famous person, the most well-known person associated with that party is Kevin MacDonald, although he's not the head of it or anything. He's just on the board of directors. But since he's best known, that's what I always associate with it. And Tom Sunick's another one. Yet Merlin Miller was now on Kevin Barrett's program, and he is saying, and he did actually say it, yeah, that unfortunately there's some white nationalists among our membership of this party. And he really would like to, he didn't say get rid of them, but something that meant that he'd like to see them go. And
Miller said that?
He said that. And then he said, and he doesn't like, he wants to get rid of too much white identity or white identitarianism or however he put it. I didn't write it down. I don't quite remember. It seemed like it was kind of a long word for identity, but it meant, you know, that this was a turnoff to people. And they were talking about how, and he's only on the ballot in three states. So the guy is not going to win anything. So why does he, but he's trying to reach people. Well, see, all this, it comes out again. Oh, well, I guess this is an impediment to reaching more white people. So we don't want to have any white nationalists. Well, these Sunak and McDonald's, last I knew, were called themselves white nationalists, or they backed it somehow. But, and we don't want to identify with white too much. And there was something else he said, but I mean, it's quite shocking. The way these people, once they get out there and they want to get some kind of, you know, they see that nobody's listening to them, they just water it down and think that the way to do that is to keep watering it down. And this is something that I've brought up a lot.
White cowardice. White cowardice is a huge, huge problem. I often think of John Tyndall. He was a British nationalist. He's deceased now. But he was the founder of the British National Party or the National League or whatever. But he tells a very famous story, and he says, well, I heard some of his lectures on YouTube, and he said he says, you're not going to get support from people until you show power and until you show courage. And he says, people always say, oh, you have to water your message down to attract people. And he says, don't underestimate our people. And he tells a story about how he was running for some office, and he had a program of repatriation of the non-whites back to Africa, and they would get money and, you know, whole complicated scheme. And they said, well, there's this woman in East London, and if you go and you talk to her, she controls, you know, the whole neighborhood, and you'll get, you know, 350 votes just by this one known person. And he tells about how he went to the flat, and this little old diminutive English woman is there, this East Londoner, you know, and he gives this whole big spiel about, oh, you know, we're going to repatriate him and they're going to get money and this whole complicated thing. And he says, to his great astonishment, when he's through delivering this presentation to this woman, she says, and he says in an East London accent, which is very, very distinctive. And he says, well, love, she says, that's all very fine and well, but frankly, I rather think we need someone like Hitler.
Yeah.
And I've heard that story repeated, in various places. But I'm thinking more and more, that's what we need. We need to just come out and be honest. We want the same rights to advocate our interests as the blacks and the Mexicans and the Jews. For God's sakes, the Jews have their own damn country, generously funded by tax money taken from millions of dumb goyim, with or without their consent. So if they can have their own country, I ought to be able to have a white student union or a white newspaper. And I think white people are awakening. And one sign of that, as I said earlier, is the fact that these subjects are now being discussed in a way that they haven't been discussed since the 50s or the 60s.
Okay, but I think we need to speed up the awakening. I think we need to do everything we can to speed up the awakening, because, you know, it can be much too slow and be too late. Because and maybe we need to take these people by surprise, because if we slowly awaken, they've got all kinds of plans. I brought this up before. Don't think that somehow we're going to wake up and we're going to overwhelm the opposition as though they're sleeping. They're not sleeping. We're the ones that have been sleeping.
Well, I understand all that, but I don't know how to speed it up. I mean,
I don't either. So since we don't, let's move on to something I've been kind of waiting to move into right here before our break. I'll just bring it up. And that you said earlier in the program that you mentioned Obama and what a terrible guy he was, really, and not a loyal American. And you say, well, that's another issue. Well, I think we should talk about that. And I would like to hear whatever you want to say about Obama. And you mentioned an article in News what is it, Views with News with Views or whatever. I didn't have a chance to go and look at it. That was just from a few weeks ago. And then I want to talk about his UN speech a little bit.
Right.
That you had some comments to make about that, too. And I also want to, you know, I'd like to share in that some of the things he said there, which reveal so much about him. So would you like to just say what you'd like to say about him before the break, and then we'll continue with the speech?
Well, before I leapfrog into a new area, I'd like to follow up to your argument about how the awakening of white people is coming much more slowly than we would like. And this is a source of frustration to white nationalists. We have all these meetings and all we ever do is talk and nothing else ever happens. And we have websites, we talk on the internet, but nothing else ever happens. Look, you're keeping the flame alive. You can't light a fuse if you don't have a candle. Okay, we're the candle. We're the fuse. We're the candle. We're the flame that's going to light that fuse. As Shakespeare so famously said in Julius Caesar, his famous play, said, there is a tide in the affairs of men. And there are historical. There are historical tides. I mean, history doesn't move in a linear fashion. You know, you're going to have, there's something that will awaken people. There's a kind of a tipping point where people get so many people get so fed up at the same time, that fuse is going to get lit and it's going to explode. But it is important that we keep talking to each other, even if it is dismissively referred to as preaching to the choir. You know, you need the revolutionary vanguard, and that's what we are. People who quietly and sometimes, we write things and it's not like, you know, all of a sudden we don't have the great awakening next week. That's going to come. And it's important that we're here to assume a position of leadership when it happens, and it's going to happen very quickly. I attended a conference where the British national guy, I forget his name, the head of the British National Party.
Griffin?
Yeah, Griffin. And he said something very interesting, and this was 2005. He says, we're one crisis away from a complete change.
Okay, well, we'll go on with that when we get back after this musical interlude.
Well,
5 minutes?
Well, how do you do? Young Willie McBride, do you mind if I sit here down by your graveside and rest for a while? Need the warm summer sun. I've been walking all day and I'm nearly done. I see by your gravestone you are only 19 when you joined the Great Fallen in 1916. I hope you died well, and I hope you died clean. Our young Willie McBride was it slow and obscene. Did he beat the drum slowly? Did he play the fife slowly? Did they sound the death march as they lowered you down? And did the band play the last post and chorus? Did the pipes play the flowers of the forest? Did you leave it a wife or a sweetheart behind? In some faithful heart is your memory enshrined. Although you died back in 1916, in that faithful heart are you forever 19? Or are you a stranger without even a name, enclosed and forever behind the glass frame, in an old photograph torn, battered and stained, and faded to yellow in the brown leather frame? Did he beat the drum slowly? Did he play the fife slowly? Did I sound the death march as he lowered you down? Did the band play the last post and chorus? And did the pipes play the flowers of the forest. The sun, now it shines on the green fields of France. There's a warm summer breeze that makes the red poppies dance. And look how the sun shines from under the clouds. There's no gas, no barbed wire, there's no gun firing now. But here in this graveyard, it's still no man's land. The countless white crosses stand mute in the sand. To man's blind indifference, to his fellow man, to all generation that were butchered and damned. Did he beat the drum slowly? Did he play the fife slowly? Did they sound the death march as he lowered you down? And did the band play the last post and chorus? Did the pipes play the flowers of the forest? My young Willie, my bride, I can't help wonder why. To those that lie here, know why did they die? And did they believe when they answered the call? Did they really believe that this war would end wars? Well, the sorrow, the suffering, the glory, the pain, the killing and dying were all done in vain. For young Willie McBride, it all happened again, and again and again and again and again. Did they beat the drums?
Well, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn Yeager, and my guest today is Don, who is a lawyer in California, and we've been having an interesting talk that I think you're probably enjoying. There's quite a few more listeners than we started out with, and welcome to you. I want to remind you once again, since I have more people listening now, that at 6 p.m. tonight on the White Network, there will be the debut of Robert Lloyd's new program, which is Rockin' the Music World. And I've heard the program. It's pre-recorded, and it will air, though, at 6 p.m. on Saturdays. And I've heard this first one, and it's very good, very interesting. I know people are going to enjoy it, so I recommend that you tune into that. Well, okay, Don, here we are back again, and you made some good comments there at the end. I'm glad you did you complete what you wanted to say?
Yes, I did. I did complete it insofar as the issue of, the awakening and why I think it's going to come. But I think it's going to be triggered. I think the white race is going to have to be culled for its own good. I think a lot of us are going to have to go down the tubes before white people really wake up. And maybe that's a good thing. I mean, I used to have arguments about, gun control with people and owning guns, and I've been a gun owner all my life, and people would say, well, if I need, they always say kind of contemptuously and patronizing me, well, if I ever need protection or a gun, if I, my family's threatened, I'll just call you. And I said, well, no, you won't. I said, I'm willing to defend my own family, but I'm not willing to defend yours. And I said, frankly, when morally and intellectually confused people get killed off because they don't believe in self-defense and they don't believe in owning guns, I think it's probably a good thing for the race. It's kind of like when wolves pick off crippled deer and elk. It's good for the benefit of the herd. And I say when people like you get picked off, it's actually good for the benefit of the race. And, of course, you can imagine I would be invited back to that person's house. But that's kind of the point you have to make. There are a lot of white people who need to be culled. They need to be killed. They need to be wiped out. Who attacks you more viciously than another self-hating, gutless, cowardly white? You know, I went to a Tea Party meeting with a sign that said equal rights for whites, and I was practically lynched. These are the white people I'm fighting to save. I mean, sometimes I wonder if it's even worth the effort.
Well, so, I was almost going to talk about that today if I didn't find you to come on with me, which I'm very glad that I did ask you and you did agree to come on. Because I wait too long to ask people, was what I've been doing lately. But I was almost going to talk about, I've just recently been having these thoughts about, not only white people in general, but even white nationalists, and wondering, you know, is it worth it to do all this for people who don't seem to want to do that much for themselves? I don't have anything better to do, I guess. But, you know, it is a question, and we have to keep from going there, though, really, I think. We shouldn't go there. Because we have to look at the best of our people and the best of our culture and our history and our civilization and not the worst of it.
I absolutely agree. The point I'm making is white cowardice is a significant problem, and we're going to have to deal with it at some level. And it's not
just cowardice. It's the people who are completely clueless and don't care and are never going to care. And also the sick ones, the ill ones, the disabled ones, the this and the that. I mean, I run into so many of these people. You wonder what, you know, and then they're the ones who the most money is spent on to keep them going, because they're not productive. And so, you know, they're just takers. And I know that's a horrible people, just really, that's Nazi. You know, they really can tear into you. You have to be so careful about your language, but it's true. It's true. And they just drag, it's a lot of people just drag the whole thing down because they don't contribute much of anything, but they're only somebody you're supposed to feel sorry for. Anyway,
I don't know about that. I think the impulse to care for one's own people is a very good impulse. But I think there's a lot of dysfunctionalism in white people today, and just self-contempt and self-hatred, and they're like rudderless ships. But that's what we have to deal with.
Dysfunctional is the word I would pick out from that. Okay, well, let me just say, to move away from this terrible topic here, that, you know, thinking about Obama, I did want to talk about his speech, and I want you, though, to tell us about this article first. What it brings up to me is something that I've been interested in, that's the connection between homosexuality and Holocaust. Now, there isn't a real connection there, but the fact that the people who push homosexuality also tend to push Holocaust, and the people that push the Holocaust also push homosexuality. And to me, there are two things that need to be, that are big, big problems for us that are destructive to our white way of life and our white functioning and so on. So I tie those together in Barack Obama, because he has made a big push in favor of homosexuals, and he also continues to get very involved in his speeches in attacking Holocaust denial and defending the Holocaust. More than he should as president of the United States, I think. Not that other ones didn't do it too. And so this brings us to Obama, and these issues. And you had mentioned to me that I know you have a very low opinion of Obama, but you don't have such a low opinion of all blacks. So it's not just because he's black. It's other reasons. And would you mind saying a little bit about that?
Yeah, I could actually say quite a bit about Obama. I've studied him in some depth. I've read both of his books, not once, but several times. I've annotated them extensively. I've extensively reviewed as many of the photographs of his earlier years as I could find. Virtually all of them are fraudulent. They're composites. They've been photoshopped. In 2007, the Honolulu Advertiser, a local newspaper, ran a nice little puff piece about, the local boy made good. he had declared for the presidency, is seated in the United States Senate. And they have a picture. They illustrate this photograph with a photograph of purportedly Obama in a high school group picture, you know, like you'll have a club or a group or something. They look very carefully at the photograph, and you look at the person on whose body his head has been affixed, and the sleeve is rolled up, and you can see very clearly the arm. Well, it's a white person's arm. You know, mm-hmm. How smart do you have to be to figure that one out? They pasted a black person's head on a white person's body. And everybody else in the photograph is looking toward the camera. Only Obama is looking off to the side in a different direction. Well, this is a classic sign of a composite photograph, where you have one person who has been inserted into a picture is behaving differently from everyone else. And your listeners can see this if they just Google Honolulu advertiser February 2007 melting pot. They can see this photograph for themselves. There's another interesting thing about it. It identifies his mother as Shirley Ann Dunham. Her official name has always been Stanley Ann, but in this she shows up as being named Shirley. Now, there was a guy named David Remnick who wrote a kind of a study of Obama. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author and all this kind of thing, works for Random House. The Cosmopolitan... The New Yorker. He wrote for the New Yorker magazine. And in a press release for that book, they identify Obama's mother as Shirley Ann Dunham. I think it's awfully screwy that the publisher of two of Obama's books and supposedly the authoritative biographer of this guy can't even figure out what his mother's real name is. And so there was an old World War II story about how the British created a fictitious person. It's called A Man Who Never Was, and they made it into a movie. Mm-hmm. It's one of those old grainy black and white movies where they got a corpse and they created an identity for this person, and they stuffed his pockets full of papers about a supposed invasion, and they put through his body in the water so it washed ashore, and the Germans found it, and they read all this information, and they had their armies in the wrong place when the invasion came, okay? Well, we've seen this in spy movies where they create a background for somebody and then he's going to go in and impersonate someone. Well, it's almost as though Obama is an artificial person whose background has been created. And you read his books, the timelines are all off. He has the wrong year that he went to Harvard, the wrong year that he met his wife, the wrong year that he attended, that he worked in a law firm. There are all kinds of just factual mistakes about this man's life. And I'm thinking... I've been a lawyer many years, and I've probably taken 400 depositions where I've asked people. And you always start off, you know, about their background and where they were born, their education, their work history. I've never met a single person, most especially a professional person, who couldn't just sit down and give an accurate, honest representation of their life's history. But here is a man who's published two books, and one of them, his second book, Audacity of Hope, he acknowledges somebody who fact-checked the thing for 3 or 4 months, and the thing is full of all kinds of mistakes. Yeah. He makes an incredible statement in there. He says, America and its transition from an agricultural society to an industrial society never had any of the violent upheavals that occurred in Europe in its transition. And I'm thinking, no violent upheavals? What the hell does he call a civil war, if not a violent upheaval? I mean, any person with the most with a fifth grade understanding of American history knows that we had a civil war. It was 4 years long. 700,000 Americans died. It was indeed a very violent thing. So you see statements like that that just make you rub your eyes. And then there's another statement where he has some quotation from Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln says capitalism is a good thing, but it causes a lot of harm. Blah blah blah. Well, I've read all of Lincoln's works. I have the 8-volume Rutgers University collected writings of Lincoln. I read all of it once, a good deal of it twice, and a fair amount of it 3 times. And I knew instantly Lincoln never said that. So I did a computer check on the online version, and the word capitalism does not appear. See, the word capitalism did not appear in the English language until a translation of the German edition of Marx's Das Kapital. That was published in 1867, 2 years after Lincoln died. So Lincoln most certainly never made this statement. You know, I'm sitting here with my general knowledge, on the Internet for half a day and read his books, and I can figure out the guy's a phony, for God's sakes. But here you see these Harvard intellectuals, one of whom was the head of the history department at Harvard University, coming out and saying, oh, these wonderful books, this guy's a genius, he's this great intellect. And then there's that famous gaffe where he gets up and says that his uncle was with the U.S. Army when it liberated Auschwitz. Well, anybody with the most basic history of World War II knows Auschwitz was on the Eastern Front, and the U.S. Army was nowhere near it. It was the Red Army that occupied Auschwitz. And something even more telling than that, in 2009, he attended some conference of Latin American leaders, and they gave him hell about Yankee imperialism and the Bay of Pigs, blah, blah, blah. And so he gets up and apologizes for this country like a pathetic jerk, you know, a pathetic jerk. I can't even believe this guy is a lawyer. No lawyer would sell his client out the way he sold out our country. So he gets up and apologizes and grovels. But he says something very interesting. He says, I think it's really wrong to criticize me for the Bay of Pigs. And he says, something that happened when I was only 4 months old. Okay, look at the timeline. Bay of Pigs, April 61. When was Obama born? According to the birth certificate, August of 61. 4 months later, Obama wasn't born when the Bay of Pigs happened, at least not according to the official version. Yet he gets up and says, well, I was only 4 months old at that time.
So he got the 4 months backwards.
And the man doesn't know when he was born. And you read his book, Dreams from My Father, which is a ghostwritten piece of crap. There's not a single complete date in the entire book. He has so little confidence about his own life narrative and his own life story that he doesn't put a single date in the book. There are references to this happened in that year and that happened in that year, but not even his own birth date. See, this man is like a man who has made up a story, and every trial lawyer has seen this, where people come in with their phony bullshit lies, and then they forget the speech they're supposed to give, like an actor hasn't.
I have to say that that's exactly like Elie Wiesel. You know, and I'm very familiar with the way he's written all his stuff, and that's exactly the same thing. And he's a big fraud. So continue.
Well, there you go. There you go. That's what I'm saying. There's something strange about this. Very, very strange about this man. And if you read his books, I mean, Dreams from My Father is almost an encyclopedia of negative black stereotypes. It's amazing. He has all this barely concealed hatred of white people and European civilization. But I'll tell you one thing that's very interesting. If you go to page 440 of Dreams of My Father, he talks about his wedding in 1992, and his half-Indonesian, half-white sister is at the wedding. And Barack Obama has something very interesting to say. He says, I watched Maya, his sister, politely fending off the advances of some brothers who thought they were slick, but who were, in fact, much too old for her and should have known better. Okay, brothers means black guys, right?
Yeah, right.
Okay, how old do you think his sister was?
I don't know. How old was she?
Okay, the way this thing's written.
8 years old or something.
She's 15 years old, and all these black guys are trying to hit on her. Hell, she was 22. She was 22 years old. She's old enough to screw all the black guys she wants. Who the hell was this guy to tell his sister and interfere with her reproductive rights, right? I mean, if they want...
So the sister was 22 at that time, and he was saying
He doesn't want the brothers screwing around with his sister, okay? Maybe that's because of what happened to his 17-year-old mother when she screwed around with one of the brothers, and he left her with a baby and took off to his other wife and all his other women. The man, if a white person said, I don't want the brothers hitting on my white daughter, you'd be lynched as a racist. But very clearly, in his own words, he doesn't want the brothers hitting on his sister. Now, what does that say about this man? What does that say about him?
I don't know.
Well, I think it says he's pretty disturbed. I think it's something very telling. I posted this on a couple of...
Well, his mother was disturbed. I mean, what do you think about his mother?
Well, if he doesn't want his own sister messing around with black guys, that raises an interesting question. Are his daughters going to be allowed to date black guys?
Oh, yeah. Well, they're probably marry white guys. That would
be an interesting turn on it.
Yeah, yeah.
But then you read his book and you read about his so-called community organizing. Okay, he goes to Chicago. This is after he graduated, supposedly from Columbia, yet before he became a lawyer and went to Harvard. And he's talking about the poor blacks and the black in the house, the Chicago Housing Authority, okay? And the roofs leak, and there's urine all in all the hallways, and the windows are broken, and nothing works, and they can't get anything fixed. And so he's on this great crusade to get social justice for these poor, discriminated victims, blacks. Okay, Chicago Housing Authority. Who do you think owns the Chicago Housing Authority? I don't know. Dirty, rotten, white racists control the Chicago Housing Authority when they had a black mayor named Harold Washington? And he admits in his book the people who ran this thing and who treated the blacks like crap were themselves politically appointed blacks.
Mm-hmm.
So he achieved substantially nothing for them. So now he's gonna go into the schools and he's gonna quote unquote reform the schools. And all this hand wringing and black the achievement gap, blah blah blah. And it's kind of an interesting thing. He talks to these black school principals and these black school administrators. No dirty, rotten, white racists are keeping the black kids down, but you have all these black principals. And they talk about the need for a black curriculum, black studies, African history, African culture. And so what is his approach to help the situation? They get like a couple of $100 million from the state of Illinois for a system that's going to provide mentors and counselors. I mean, mentors and counselors? Mentor. So when the same black kids who go out and reproduce like feral cats and dogs are told by their parents, you know, don't screw every guy in the freshman class, and the kids say, screw you, now the kids are going to listen to counselors and mentors when they don't pay any attention to their parents? What is the purpose of this program?
Well, there's none.
Clearly, it's funneling money to the black people. And he talks about this one black principal. And when they get the funding and this program is going to be in place for counselors, the black principal pulls out resumes for his wife and his daughter, and he wants to get them onto the payroll. This is the black approach to everything. You get more money in and you get more black people on the white payroll.
Well, that's because they learned all that from the Jews. But I'm not trying to absolve the blacks, because they're a real big problem. But that's where they learn all that.
The issue isn't where do they learn it. The issue is that's the way they are.
Right.
And if you look at Obama's story, he says his white mother, when they were in Indonesia, used to wake him up at 4 a.m. and tutor him every day. Okay, on correspondence courses. Obama never says to the black mothers, turn off the TV set and do homework with your kids. He never says that. The obligation, the responsibility for their failures, for their performance, is shifted to the dirty, rotten, white taxpayer who is ordered to pay more money in taxes.
And I don't think he's that smart or educated, and therefore that story that his mother woke him up at 4 a.m. to tutor him could be a big lie.
Well, I don't know why it would be.
He's supposed to have learned so much. He's supposed to be so smart, you know, and be material for these Columbia University and so on.
As someone who was raised with a white mother who tutored me when I was not doing that well, I can relate to that. And I think it's very interesting that if you watch the blacks and how they deal with quote-unquote poverty, go read some American history and go read a book called On Plymouth Plantation by William Bradford. It's the story of the Pilgrims and how they landed here in the dead of winter. Half of them perished because of the harshness of the elements. I mean, talk about poverty. They didn't have indoor plumbing or electricity or any of the other modern conveniences that all of these pampered blacks have, yet they overcame it. They built a civilization, and they looked and relied upon their own strength and their own character, and that's what we as white people have to do. When you read those two books one after the other, you see the difference in the people, the difference in the character, the difference in the worldview. A truly strong people and a race of parasites.
Mm-hmm. You know. Well, that's true.
And I'm sorry about that, but that's just the way that they are. I mean, you know, they gave them their own country, Liberia. What did they do with that? They immediately slipped back into poverty.
And they will. You know, if you set them up in Africa, it's not going to last. But it has to be clear that it's not up to us to make sure that they succeed, because you can't make sure that they succeed.
During the Civil War, Lincoln was a big proponent of colonization, and during the Civil War, they acquired the rights to an island off Haiti, and it was a nice island. It was fertile land, fresh water, moderate climate, very fertile soil. So they sent a colony of blacks down there to set up a black community. 6 months later, they had to bring them all home because nobody did any work. Nobody planted any crops.
We know that. I mean, we're not surprised at that. What about Obama's having homosexual tendencies?
I never paid a whole lot of attention to that. But recently, there were a couple of stories on WorldNet Daily in one of the stories is how he has worn a wedding ring ever since he was a freshman in college. And there are percipient photographs taken of him at Occidental College that show him wearing a wedding ring. And at Yale Law School, there was a parody story about him. And one of the, it joked that one of his biggest challenges was explaining to people the gold band on his left hand. And I thought,
okay, you know, said he was wearing a wedding ring since when?
Since he was in college, since he was 18 years old.
Since 18, okay.
Now he also, he has a Pakistani roommate. And you see photographs of him and the roommate, and they're sitting together on a couch. They're sitting next to each other, touching. I mean, how many guys do you know, and they go sit down on a couch, touch each other?
I don't know.
You know, guys don't do that. You would think that that's creepy. I mean, if guys sit down on a couch, there's going to be at least an arm's length between them. Mm-hmm. You know, assuming it's not a crowded room and it's a party and, you know, 10 people are squeezed in onto the couch. That's a little different. But on this couch, it's just them in the picture, just them on the couch, and they're touching each other. They're practically sitting in each other's lap. And you look at it, and it's the creepiest looking thing you ever saw. And you look at this Pakistani guy. He's some filthy, greasy-looking guy. You want to get out your fly swatter, you know, or your can of Raid, and send him on to his final reward. Who think of sex with that? My God, you know.
Okay, well, what else
but
do they?
Then
what
there
about
was a,
this
another story on WorldNet Daily that has come out, and there's some homosexual activist. I think his name was Kevin Dujan. In Chicago, and he has come out and said, yeah, Obama was very big in the homosexual community, the bathhouse community here in Chicago. He's very well known in that community. And they were quite stunned when he got the nomination for the presidency, because they thought that his very well-known, open, and notorious association with homosexuals would pretty much doom his presidential chances. And here this guy's got a name. He has a blog out there. He's a real person, and he says in 10 to 15 years, this stuff is going to be very well known and very well accepted. So apparently there is a line of evidence there that Obama is a serious homosexual and has been for many, many years.
And then in politics, the Republican, the opposite party will never, ever use any of this stuff. Now, I'm not saying they can just come out and accuse him of something they don't have proof of. But there's a whole lot of stuff about Obama, and they never bring it up. And it was the same way with Kerry and Bush. The debacle of the debates with Bush wearing that thing in the back of his jacket. I thought, well, you know, I was a Kerry supporter then, sorry to say, but, you know, I was, because I really disliked Bush. And that was before my total change around. So I thought, boy, they got him now. Look at that, boy, you know. He's a goner. No, they wouldn't talk about it. They wouldn't talk about it. That's what really did me in with the Democrats. I said, gee.
Well, that's just, I think a lot of these people are controlled opposition.
Well, that's right.
Lot of this, but, you know, if we can't get past this phony birth certificate his birth certificate's a total phony. I don't know where the guy was born. I frankly don't think he was born in Africa. Because it's very unlikely. I read the father's another piece of work, the African guy. I read his immigration file. He's another one. He's got two separate dates of birth listed in his immigration file. One shows his year of birth is 1934. The other one is 1936. And these are in documents that were filled in his own handwriting. So, I mean, it's like these people, I don't know, they're all grifters and con men. They don't know when they were born. It's just bizarre. It's totally bizarre. But that being said, I don't believe he was born in Africa. I don't believe that, but I do believe the birth certificate is a forgery. It's a fraud.
I think so, too.
The certification numbers are out of order with other authentic birth certificates that were issued. There was a woman who's had twins in the same hospital the next day, and she came forward with her birth certificates, and they were filed after Obama's birth certificate was filed with the government there in Honolulu, but her numbers are lower than his, and that's physically impossible. Documents are recorded in government offices in chronological order, in the order that they come in, and so for those documents to have lower numbers, even though they were filed several days later, is just not possible. I've done a lot of work with real estate fraud and things like that, and when you have documents where the numbers are out of sequence, that means there's a forgery afoot. you know, you get a title insurance claim where somebody comes and claims they own the mortgage to your house, and because they have a senior lien, and you know, you just go down to the recorder's office and compare the dates with the certification numbers, and you can expose it fairly easily. You can't do that with this birth certificate because they got all these goofball privacy laws that protect frauds like him and make it very difficult to detect it. But that I guess that's another show. But you asked me about Obama, and that
well,
is just,
yeah, you know, I read about those. I read that stuff too, and it all makes sense to me. I mean, it's totally, there's no, absolutely, this stuff should be looked into if there was any honesty. I mean, Congress, someone should be looking into this, the Justice Department, but of course that's appointed by him. But so let's put this together with what you're saying about the anti-slavery people in the 1830s and how they didn't want the slaves to leave. They wanted to, you know, make one nation of black and white. And now we have Obama and all this overlooking everything. And, well, everything that goes on, you know, who is behind all this? What is behind all this?
Well, I don't think Obama really wants racial amalgamation. I think he wants white people exterminated. You're not going to have much amalgamation when white people are completely gone. I think he hates white people. He has this weird, bizarre attachment to Muslims that I don't understand at all. Like he said in a Cairo speech a couple of years ago, he was going to use his efforts to create as much goodwill as he could for Islam. And I thought, well, that's an interesting take on the wall of separation between church and state, when he can transform the presidency of the United States into an ambassadorship of goodwill for one particular religion. And then he had his African head of NASA say that one of the major tasks of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration was going to be outreach to Muslims. I couldn't figure that one out. But he seems to be more pro-Islam than he is pro-Jew. I don't think he really likes Jews very much.
But he still has to.
I think he's still very much in their corner.
Absolutely.
But you said originally we were going to talk about his UN speech and the relationship of homosexuality and Holocaust denial. Mm-hmm. The only thing I thought about that was remarkable about his UN speech, this is, of course, in the aftermath of all the problems in Libya, and where he talks about, oh, we have to condemn, you know, insults to religion, and we have to condemn Holocaust denial, is, and this is something we may have talked about before, is the elevation of the Holocaust legend to kind of the status of a religion. And the status of a religion, of a religious belief as opposed to a secular historical belief, is that one is subject to proof, one is subject to research, analysis, and methods of testing and investigation, and the other is a religious belief. You simply take it on faith. And it strikes me that by lumping the Holocaust legend in with religions, it's basically an admission that it is a form of religion. It is something that is required to be taken on faith, since as a matter of law, any other kind of analysis or rational analysis into it has been criminalized. So if we can't teach creation science in the schools because that is based on blind faith and religious doctrine, we obviously should not be allowed to teach the Holocaust legend in schools because that is also based on blind faith and a kind of a religious doctrine. Kind of an interesting thing happened some years ago. There was a guy named Michael Shermer. He publishes a magazine called Skeptic, and he wrote a book about Holocaust denial and blah, blah, blah. So I wanted to look at the book, and I went to a bookstore, and I said, and I couldn't find it in the history section. And the guy go to the clerk, and he types into the computer. He says, oh, it's in the religious section under Judaica. I thought, what? And I thought, well, what could be more appropriate? This has really become an article of Jewish faith, of Jewish religion. It's not history. It's religion. And they shouldn't be able to shove it down our throats under the First Amendment prohibition of the establishment of a religion. Now, it's kind of an arcane kind of a thing, but it's an important thing nonetheless. This is a phony scam belief based on blind faith. It cannot withstand historical secular analysis. And I think that Obama's lumping the Holocaust in with these religions and trying to get for them the same protection you would get for a religion is kind of emblematic of that.
Well, why is he doing it? You know, why should he be doing it?
Well, why not? It's the president.
He shouldn't be doing it.
They own the pink slip on him. Well, he shouldn't be doing a lot of things, but he's doing it. As for the connection, I think that's why that reference came in there. And I heard a lot of Jews on talk radio say, oh, it's really nice that he mentioned that. They're big on that.
Maybe that's why I mentioned it for them. But I'm looking for it now to get the exact wording that he used. I don't know if I missed it or what, but go ahead.
That's all I really had to say on that point. I think it was significant, and it shows that fossil legend is not history, but an article of faith.
Yeah, this was a pretty long speech. Now, he says the future must not belong to those who slander the prophet of Islam. So he mentions the prophet of Islam, which is Muhammad. Then he says, to be credible, those who condemn that slander must also condemn the hate we see when the image of Jesus Christ is desecrated. Churches are destroyed. So is there, we've got Muhammad, we've got Jesus Christ, or the Holocaust is denied. Those three things. He doesn't mention Judaism. He doesn't say anything about, because nobody attacks Judaism. Nobody does.
Well, he's in the middle of an election year, and he can't really crap on the Christians that overtly. He has to throw them a bone, and he has to go through the motions of showing some respect, even though he has none. But he has this, he almost like he speaks differently when he talks about Islam. The prophet of the thing. It's like he's talking to these people in code. And some of the conservatives, commentators said that they're going to put a very, very different meaning on that than people in this country. And that may very well be true. It's just he behaves differently. His voice changes. His body language is different. His whole personality changes when he's talking about Islam. So you think
he's Muslim and I don't think he's anything, but you think he's Muslim and He takes that seriously?
I think he has a feeling toward Islam that he doesn't have toward any other religion, and I think it's a feeling of deep respect and deference. I think he has absolute utter contempt for Christianity.
Because he was brought up in Indonesia. Do you think it came from those early years?
I don't know where it comes from. His life is so creepy, and his parents and his whole family, they're all so creepy. Many of the photographs of his grandparents, they're phony in composites too. There's what purports to be a photograph of his grandparents when he was in the army. The grandfather was in the army, and he was supposedly hugging his wife, and they're standing in front of their house in Kansas. The house is tilting at about a 10-degree angle. Okay, how could you occupy a house that's tilted at a 10-degree angle? I mean, the whole thing would slant over, the dishes would slide off the table. How do you take a bath in a house that tilts like that? And then there's another photograph on the cover of the first edition of Dreams of My Father, which shows them standing in front of the house. It's a different photograph, but the house is perfectly level in that photograph. So, I mean, why do they feel the need to make all these phony, bogus photographs if this man is really who he says he is?
Sometimes I wonder if the conspiracy is so twisted and deep that, because I was talking about this with Hadding and the protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion and who put them out, that they put this stuff out themselves, the people who are behind all this, to get people talking and wondering and make it a big topic of conversation, like this funny stuff about Obama and his birth certificate, that maybe the people who are behind all this have done all this themselves, and then they're directing all this discussion about it and calling people conspiracy, calling people birthers and truthers and this and that. Well, I mean, that's pretty far-fetched.
I don't agree with that at all. I don't agree with that at all.
Well, I wouldn't want it to be so because it's too complicated.
I don't think that at all. I think that this guy, I think he was a kind of a small-time criminal. I think he was a very undistinguished person in his life. And you have a kind of an interesting blankout. When he supposedly goes to Columbia, there's a guy named Wayne Allen Root who was at Columbia at that time, and Root has come out, he's been on several television shows, and says that can't find anybody who knew Obama when he was at Columbia. So here you've got a guy, he was in high school, he played basketball, he was in this club, he was in that club, and when he went to Occidental, he was very active. Now all of a sudden he goes to Columbia, one of the top Ivy League schools in the country, and he's the invisible man. Nobody heard of him. He's not in any photographs. There's something really creepy about that. But separate and apart from that, it's just, and then he goes into community organizing, and he did some of that in Brooklyn, New York as well. But then he gets into Harvard, and that's what's really creepy to me. You don't just apply to Harvard and get into Harvard. You know, there's like 5,000 people for every opening to get into Harvard Law School. Mm-hmm. So some very, very powerful, there's something that happened where this guy was snatched from obscurity, and he was just a, you know, your typical black radical stoner and pothead. And some people, there's something that happened, and I think it has to do with his years in Chicago, where somebody saw him, they saw that this guy had potential.
And well, what about the bathhouse in Chicago?
That
is the time that he supposedly frequented homosexual bathhouse, right?
No, that actually came later.
Later. When did that come?
When he came from Harvard. This was when he was a state senator.
Oh, a state senator.
Yeah, this is after he got out of Harvard. But I'm just saying, for him to have gotten into Harvard, this man had powerful friends in high places. It's not because of his dazzling intellect.
No, it isn't. So there again, I ask, who are these people, and why do they pick him?
I don't know. I think they picked him because he's a good con man. He's very effective. That's why they picked him. And then the answer to that is obvious.
Why did they even know about him? I mean, I'm just coming up with this for the first time, but it could be that there's a connection between homosexuality and pedophilia rings among the people in the highest positions in our world, and not just in the United States, but government and so on, but in European government.
I don't really see a homosexual conspiracy here. I think his homosexuality is just kind of an irrelevant thing off to the side.
But I'm saying that it could be tied to this, to pedophilia, which is a big, which could be a real backdrop to a lot of what's going on.
And so they find people like that. It's a huge liability to him. I don't think he was put in there to promote the homosexuality thing. I don't think that's a substantial reason why he was picked. I think it's just some personal problem he has. But I got to tell you, for him to get into Harvard, and this guy's an intellectual dim bulb. He's not that smart at all. He gets his lines screwed up. I mean, the guy writes two of his own books, and he doesn't even know when he was born. He doesn't know any of the relevant dates about his life.
He's made terrible mistakes in speaking.
He's not this great smart guy, but look, this man is powerful today and has power because some powerful people behind, some rulers, powers behind the throne, pull this guy from obscurity and put him where he is. I don't know who they are. I think it has something to do with Chicago. There's a Jewish...
All the powerful people in the world, so many of the powerful people in the world today are involved in pedophilia and pedophilia rings.
Well,
child sex, and so on.
I believe at some point in time this man will become expendable and he will be thrown under the bus. I kind of get that sense about him. He's an interesting person at a number of different levels. But
was sexually abused when he was young. He was kind of a cute black kid.
Well, he had this connection with this communist pornographer, Frank Marshall Davis, Hawaii.
Right. His mother posed for those nude photographs, and kind of in the extreme because she was showing her backside in one of them. I thought that was really in bad taste.
They were very creepy, and everything. The point is that everything about the whole family is creepy, including the father's military service. I mean, grandfather's military service. None of it makes any sense at all. The whole thing, but those are. We can get off on Obama and talk for hours about the weird stuff in the interesting I will say is this. If you look at WorldNet Daily and you look at their reporting and their investigation on this guy, they've done a very good job. And if you compare what WorldNet Daily has published about his background, all the lies and falsehood, and look at David Moranis' book. David Moranis is a very respected mainline biographer who recently published a book about Obama that exposed a lot of the misrepresentations in his books. He basically took all this stuff off of WorldNet Daily.
Yeah, so, I know WorldNet Daily has been going at it for a long time. The trouble with WorldNet Daily is that they're pro-Jewish, or at least they won't blame anything on Jews, but at least they're anti-Muslim, but they're doing a good job with the Obama investigation.
Well, I think Corsi has always been of this idea that the guy was born in Africa, and he says, yeah, the grandmother remembers it and all that crap. You know, there's no evidence this guy was born in Africa. And some old woman who says, yeah, I mean, that doesn't mean anything. They're oral culture. They have an oral culture because they never figured out written language, okay? That's why, so, you know, there was a guy who wrote an essay on the internet. He was a professor who taught in Africa, and he talked about the fact that the blacks never had written language and how it affects them. Imagine a culture where all of the knowledge of the culture exists only in the minds of the people currently alive. You know, you have no libraries, no reference book, no stored knowledge. I mean, they live on a very, very screwy level, and I think it affects them. And that's why they make this big deal about their oral heritage and their oral culture.
Sure.
And one of the interesting things I found about Dreams from My Father is kind of an encyclopedia of negative black stereotypes. You know, blacks, white people, we get hit over the head with slavery all the time. Well, in Dreams from My Father, Obama tells about how his grandfather purchased an African woman for the price of 15 cows. And this was 50, 60 years after slavery was ended in this country. And he talks about his father, you know, his African father who came to the United States and got to go to all these schools and these colleges, got to go to Harvard.
I know.
And, you know, all these white people rolled out the red carpet.
And why is it that he's the one that's become president,
Let me finish. I need to finish my thought here, okay?
Yeah.
What happens to his white father comes from Africa, gets the red carpet, gets to go to Harvard, gets all these white teenage girls offered up for his sexual gratification, goes back to Africa, and what happens? He's a member of the wrong tribe in Africa. The majority tribe there is the Kikuyu, and he's a Luo. And so he mouths off about things, and his own wonderful, humane, tolerant black ruler blacklists this guy, kick him out of his job, make it so that he can't get any work. They reduce him to poverty. They even take his passport so he can't leave the country and get a job in some other country. You read Obama's book, and as much as he hates white people and he hates white America and he beats us over the head with slavery, the real injustices and the really horrible things that are done to black people in his own book are done by other black people. And he talks to his relatives in Kenya, and they talk about how the government screws them over, it cheats them, it makes them produce coffee, and it buys the coffee dirt cheap from them, and then it sells it, and they make a big profit on the markets. There's no talk in that book about how dirty, rotten white people hurt blacks. All of their grievances are against other blacks.
Don, it's always been this way. It's always been these people who've hurt their own people. Non-white people.
Okay, and separate apart from how it's always been, this man is the poster child for the poor black and white racist. And you read his book, and his own book is the best case that could be made for the compassion and the humanity of white people and the corruption and the dysfunctionalism of blacks. My God, he lands in Kenya on his first trip there, and they lose his luggage, okay? So he goes back to the counter to get his luggage, and it's almost funny to read it. And basically, he talks about the two black women are there, and one of them's reading a magazine, and the other one's talking about her boyfriend in a nightclub. And he says, yeah, I'm here to try to find my baggage. And they basically say, you know, we don't have your bags. You know, we'll call us. Don't call you. Go screw yourself, pal. We don't give a crap about that, you know. And so I think it's kind of funny in that regard, where he has so much hatred for white people, but look at the way the blacks.
Well, you know, in this UN speech, I noticed that twice he used the terms together, intolerance and violence. You know, the first one was violence and intolerance, and then he switched it around and used intolerance and violence. But I don't think that's an accident. This is what they're trying to put together all the time. This is what fits in with the Holocaust, and it also fits in with, I guess, if you're intolerant of homosexuals, you're going to commit violence against them. That's why they play up so big every time some homosexual gets harmed, and half the time some of them I brought up recently turned out to be lies by these people. So but this whole idea of tying in intolerance with violence is part of their big campaign.
I didn't hear his whole speech. I mean, it's obviously a bogus, ghost-written, multicultural type speech. I didn't think there was anything particularly significant about it. But there is something significant about this whole thing that you can't criticize Muslims. And they say speech that causes violence is speech that should not necessarily be protected speech. Well, stop and think about that. Speech doesn't cause violence. Violence is caused by violent people who react to speech. Now, it's one thing where you have language of incitement, where I say, you know, you get the tar, you get the feathers, and we're going to go lynch this guy. That clearly is incitement, because it is a direction or a request by one person of another person or group of people to do a violent act. Well, you know, look at this stupid goofball movie they made about Mohammed. I mean, it's a joke, but it's a parody. It's a satire. And now we're told that the Constitution does not protect parody and satire, and that this speech causes violence. Okay, speech does not cause violence. Violence is caused by violent acts. But they want to equate in the mind that it is the speech of the speaker that causes the violent act of some third person.
But he also says in the speech, he does point out that speech should never provoke violent acts. They don't condone that at all. But what they do say that I think is dangerous.
Yeah, but you see,
okay, go ahead.
What is provocation? If I get up and say whites should have equal rights, that's provocation, and they can come beat me up. There are minorities who say that. Yeah, that's provocation. Mm-hmm. That's provocation. These words are important, because these words are going to be used to silence and gag white people. And that's
well, I know, but they're
protecting. Minorities, like, here is the point, that minorities don't have the self-discipline and the self-control to conduct themselves in accordance with the rules of civilized conduct, i.e. to respect somebody else's speech.
Okay,
is the way they shift responsibility from the violent person to the person who said something. This is called the heckler's veto, whereby somebody can threaten violence against another person, and they use the threat they themselves created as a pretext for silencing the other person whose speech they don't want to hear.
Well,
that is the conceptual thing that has to be understood here. This is a word game. This is a trick that is going to be used to trick people into consenting to their own silencing and the imposition of a gag rule on them by these non-whites.
Mm-hmm. Right. We understand that, but most white Americans, I think they're starting to understand it. Here, in this case, I think I'd have to go along with you that they're starting to catch on to this. But he also said something that I thought was pretty terrible. He said, understand that America will never retreat from the world. We will bring justice to those who harm our citizens and our friends. So, you know, he's coming right out with that. We are doomed to, under these kinds of people, to go into the world and take up for our friends, wherever they are, you know, whoever we decide are our friends, and decide that others who are harming these people are our enemies. And this is what's called justice, and this is the plan to continue. And I think we need to get this very clear, too. Americans need to get this very clear, that there's no end to this, that it's one world.
Well, this is kind of an extension of this old Wilsonian intervention idea that we're going to bring democracy to the world, and, you know, the FDR thing in World War II, you know, make the world safe for democracy.
Yeah, but that doesn't make it less important and dangerous, because we're still doing this, and look what that brought about.
Like I said,
World War I and World War II.
I think it's just, I don't think it's all that important in regard to Obama said it. It's a generic ghostwritten speech for this guy, and but it kind of affirms that old idea that I don't think the speech made a whole lot of sense. I think it's a ghostwritten script that was handed to him for him to write, and he may have written himself the part about the Prophet Muhammad, because that seems to be a hot button with him, Islam. But I don't think the speech was all that significant. I think he had to make the speech. And he could use it as an attempt to bludgeon Americans and attack free speech. But I don't think other than that it was all that distinct.
You said you hadn't listened to it all.
No, I hadn't heard it all.
Oh, I read it all. I thought he said some things that were Well, it's long.
A lot of it's wrong. All of it's wrong. But did he say anything that's new or that departs?
Well, when do any of them say anything that's new? It's just the points that he points up, you know, and this idea of linking intolerance with violence.
Well, in Cairo, he said something new. He said America had a unique debt to Islam, and he was going to try to improve relationships with Islam. I'm not aware of any other president.
Yeah, I know. Everybody made a big, big deal out of that, but he hasn't done it.
Well, whether he did it or not, he promulgated it.
Yeah.
And that's some significance.
Well, here's something that I think is important. He said towards the end, that is why a coalition of countries, he's talking about Iran, terrible stuff he's saying. Well, he's saying that, make no mistake, a nuclear-armed Iran is not a challenge that can be contained. It would threaten the elimination of Israel. Guess, yeah.
That's plain vanilla Zionism. That's plain vanilla Zionism.
And then he says, and that is why a coalition of countries is holding the Iranian government accountable, and that is why the United States will do what we must, which means violence, to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon. I mean, you see, they're going to do whatever it takes to prevent that, but they say that they're trying to obtain this weapon, but they don't have it's clear there's no, you know, there's no scientific proof of it at all. So this is all just fraudulent BS.
Well, it's a ghost-written, plain vanilla, generic, pro-Zionist speech.
Okay. Okay, well, the other thing I thought I would like to bring up is more on this, more on Obama and homosexuality. We don't have hardly any time, but he, you know, in May of this year, he made it official. He supports same-sex marriage. Up until now, he's been saying he's leaning toward it, and he declared in 2010 that the don't ask, don't tell policy on gays will end, and it will end on my watch, he pronounced. And now he has ended it. And so, you know, he's come out. That's been a real important thing for him. Now, why is that so important? Well, I think that's part of the whole agenda.
Clearly that's part of the agenda. To promote that aberration. I mean, the creepiest thing about Obama and homosexuality, I mean, anybody can come forward and say, yeah, I knew Obama, he was in the bathhouses, blah, blah, blah. I mean, who knows whether that's even true or not. The thing I find very interesting is this guy was in college, and I've seen the photographs, and they're percipient photographs. He's wearing a wedding ring as a young single guy in college. What kind of single guy, in a young guy, wears a wedding ring?
Well, why doesn't anybody ask him about that?
Because they won't. The obvious answer, I raised this question with some people, and the women all say because he doesn't want women hitting on him.
Oh, well, that's an answer.
He's not interested in girls. He doesn't want girls hitting on him, and if he's got a wedding ring on, that's a pretext for not being interested
in
girls.
That.
And I mean, it's, you know, I've asked a number of women about that, and the subject has come up, and they all say the same thing. Yeah, he doesn't like girls. Because, you know, when you're young and you're on the make for girls, I'll tell you, the last thing I would have worn when I was in my 20s was a wedding ring. I wanted women to be interested in me. And what heterosexual male doesn't want women interested in it?
Yeah. Don, we've got less than 60 seconds left, so I want to thank you for being on the show and let you say anything you'd like to say before we close out here.
Well, the time has passed very quickly, and I'm glad that you invited me. I enjoyed it, would like to do it again, and hopefully the listeners enjoyed it.
Well, thanks. I enjoyed it, and I would like you to do it again. Oh, we've still got 30 seconds. This last minute really takes a while.
And I want the white people listening to this to realize all is not lost. This thing can be turned around. It's going to be bloody, and it's going to be brutal, but it can be, and I believe it will be turned around.
Well, we need to hear voices like that. We need to hear people who put out hope. I think that's very important. So we will do this again, Don. So be assured of that. It's been a real good show. I've enjoyed it. And listeners, don't forget about our new show at 6 p.m. tonight. So or this afternoon for many of you earlier. See you next week.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.